is today is to give you a kind of Sabbath gift. Saturday is, after all, the ancient Sabbath. So Sunday is the Lord's Day. The eighth day is the, as the old church used to call it, the day that is the day beyond the cycle of seven. Saturday is still the Sabbath. And so let's sit deep and let me read you a story. It's a story I really like, just as a story. One time my son brought it home from the library, and I read it first, and loved it. And I've used it a lot since then, and just like to share it with you, too. I will find some excuse at the end to relate it to what I want to say. Maybe to twist it around, even. But if you don't want to pay too much attention to my excuses, that's fine, if you can just enjoy the story. The story is called The Throne of the Earl of Shurl. Throne, T-H-R-O-M-E. The story is filled with words like that are sort of made-up words. It's a story sort of, if you know Lewis Carroll's The Jabberwocky, it's a story kind of that edges on The Jabberwocky in some ways, because it keeps making up words that almost sound like words but aren't quite. And there's lots of words like that in it. I've sort of decided that throne is made up of threnody, which is a word for lament, and poem. I think that's a nice combination. The Throne of the Earl of Shurl. It is also a love story, and maybe chiefly a love story. Maybe you can just enjoy it as that. But in the end, when I'm done with what I want to read of it, and I'm just going to read the first and the last chapters and sort of summarize the middle, I want to relate it to the liturgy. That may or may not work. Well, The Throne of the Earl of Shurl, Chapter 1. The Earl of Shurl wrote a throne. It was a deep throne, and a dark, haunting, lovely throne. A wild, special, sweet throne, made of the treasure of words in his deep heart. He wrote it long ago in another world, a vaguely singing, boundaryless land that did not exist within the kingdom of Magnus Thrall, king of everywhere. The king had knights to come and go for him, and turtles to plant and harvest for him, but no knight had ever looked up into the winking morning sky and seen Shurl, and no turtle had ever looked at the rich clods of earth between his boots and seen the earl's world. Yet the earl, long, long ago, wrote a throne of singular and unsurpassed beauty, somewhere in his own land called Shurl, and the dark king of everywhere desired that throne. The house of the king was a tall thing of great thick stones and high towers and tiny slits of windows that gleamed at night when the king paced his hearthstones longing for the throne. He had a daughter who sat with him and wept and embroidered pictures of the green world beyond the walls, and listened to her father think aloud to the pale sunlight or the wisps of candle flame. Who knows, he would say, or who knows where lies the throne of peace, the throne of loveliness, the dark throne of Shurl. I must have it. If I had it, the most precious of all precious things, my heart would be at rest in its beauty, and I could stop wanting. If I had the throne, I could wake at mornings knowing it belonged to me, and I could be content with the simple sunrise and the silly birds. The king's damsel would lift her hands and let them fall again into her lap. There is no such thing. There is no throne. Everyone knows that. Bah! Everyone is a fool. And a tear would slide down the still face of the king's damsel and plop and twinkle on her hands. Her long hair was the color of pale sunlight, and her eyes were the color of long, motionless, uninterrupted nights. Somewhere beyond the dark stones was a moon-haired knight who loved the sad, sighing damsel of the king. That knight came one night to the house of Magnus Thrall. Damsel, who from the high window had seen the turtles come and go and the daylight come and go, saw the night right across the fields of everywhere, and thump on the drawbridge of the house, which shut itself up at night like a grim, wordless sprite. Her sad, sighing heart gave two quick beats. Magnus Thrall, wearing a circle in the stones in front of a skinny, dancing elf of flames, stopped. "Who thumped across my drawbridge?" "It is your chief knight, Carlos," said Damson, and her voice was like the low, clear ripple of water across the stones. "Ha!" said Magnus Thrall. "I know what he has come for, but he cannot have you because I need you. If you go away, I will be here alone here in these dark, dank walls. I need to look at your sad face. It comforts me." A tear dropped onto Damson's needlework and winked like a jewel among the bright threads. She looked towards the door at the sound of footsteps. They came through dark halls and empty rooms and lightless, winding staircases towards her. For the king had shut up his house so that he could wail and wish alone. Spiders wove tapestry on the cold gray walls, and dust gathered motionless on the stone floors. The footsteps stopped at the doorway, and the knight Carlos stood in it, looking in at the warm fire, and the king, and Damson with her eyes like cups of sweet, dark wine. He smiled at her eyes, and they smiled back sadly beneath their tears. "Go away," Magnus Thrall said. "I just arrived," Carlos said reasonably. "My horse is in your disused stable. He is tired, and I am tired, both of us having followed the sun and the moon to get here."
"You are welcome," said Damson.
"You are not," said Magnus Thrall. "Besides, we have no room for you." "I will rest content on the cold stones," Carlos said. "And in the morning, I will come and ask something of you, and then I will leave you." "I will give you an answer now," said the king. "No." Carlos sighed. He stepped into the room. It was thick with fur beneath the foot, shining here and there with gold or silver or dark polished wood. Damson's needlework hung on the walls. New flowers, pink and gold and midnight blue, sat in water on the table. Such things would Damson do in Carlos's house, bringing with her sad, lovely thoughts. He stood tall and straight before the king, his shirt of mail silvery as fish scale, his sword and his shield of three moons at his side, proper and fair from his carefully brushed moon-colored hair to his gleaming mouse-colored boots. "I have come for Damson," he said to her wet face turned towards him like a dawn flower. "It is the time in my loving when I want no long sunlit road between us and no stone wall and closed door. You will leave without her."
"But why? You are growing a flower in the dark. You are shutting a rare stone up in a locked box."
"Why should I give my flower to you? You will shut her away in your own stones to weep and sow beside your hearth."
"But I love her," Carlos protested.
Magnus Thralls folded his arms and looked into the fire. Tears of pity welled in Damson's eyes.
"You know nothing of wanting," said the king.
"You know nothing of the gnawing beast of wanting. You want the ceaseless whine of wanting. You want Damson. My wanting is greater than yours. My wanting can make a great house empty, can make a silly world empty. I want the throne of Shirl. Find it for me, and I will give you anything you want." Carlos's mouth opened. It closed again, and then the words in his eyes came to it.
"There is no such thing as the throne of Shirl," he whispered.
"Magnus Thrall, that is unfair. The throne is a lie left from another king, another year. There never was a throne. There was never a land called Shirl. There is nothing but the earth and the sky." Magnus Thrall whirled away from the fire.
"Unfair? What is unfair about wanting? Somewhere, somewhere, Carlos, you will find the throne. Until then, I will grow my flower in the dark."
"You are cruel and loveless in your wanting."
"I know," Magnus Thrall whispered. "I know. The throne is my hope. Find it for me, Carlos."
"But it does not exist."
"Find it for me."
"Find it, Carlos," said Damson. He turned his hands outstretched.
"But it does not exist."
"I know, but please find it, Carlos."
Is there no reason in this dark, empty house? Magnus Thrall, you are king of everywhere. You should open your doors, open your gates, open your hands and heart to me, to Damson, to all your knights, to your vessels and turtles. Put tapestries on your bare walls, flame on your cold torches. Go into the green world and be content with what beauty is everywhere, that you cannot see when your eyes are blind with wanting. Give me Damson. I love her. The Dark King stood unflickering by the fire. There is a price, he said, on your loving. There is a price for the taking of Damson from my hearth to yours. There should be no price. Give me the throne. Then you may have my Damson. The knight Carlos closed his eyes and sighed. Then he went to the window where Damson sat, the stars clustering about her hair. He took her hands and said sadly, "Will you wait for me?" "I will," said Damson, and a star fell down her cheek. "But oh, please hurry." "I will, though I do not know what use it is to hurry when I do not know where I am going and when there will be nothing to find when I get there." "I know," Damson said sorrowfully. "My Carlos, you will be searching forever and I will grow old and ugly, and when you find it, you will not want me anymore." "Yes, I will. I will be old and ugly too then." He kissed her sadly, gently farewell. Then he said to Magnus Thrall, "I will find your throne, whether it exists or not. I will return with the price for her." "I know you will," said Magnus Thrall. "That is why I set that price." And so the knight Carlos came to leave the king's house by starlight, looking for the throne of the Earl of Shirl. He stared up at the quiet stars as he crossed the drawbridge, and they twinkled sympathetically on his upturned face. "But it does not exist," he mourned to them. "Does it?" Well, that's chapter one. The story continues with his adventures in looking for the non-existent throne of the Earl of Shirl. And he, in the course of his adventures, he is progressively disinvested, interestingly enough. He goes out the chief knight of Magnus Thrall, the king of everywhere, riding on his horse with his armor and his sword and his mouse-colored boots and his shield. And slowly he loses all these things, or trades them, or has to sort of trade them for some service or information, or just for love. Instead of his horse, he starts riding a dog, which is called the Dagon. Instead of his sword, he carries a star wand. Instead of his shield, he is given a harp. Instead of his armor, he is talked into wearing a leaf cloak. And finally, he gives up his mouse-colored boots and goes barefoot. So he is sort of reduced to a tree man, as he is called later on, and a kind of crazy figure. In the process, he encounters all kinds of people, and they tell him, of course, where he ought to look for the throne of the Earl of Shirl, all of which places don't exist. The Mirkwell of Morg, the Floral Wold at the World's End, the Dolorous House of the Dead Dolmen, and the Western Wellsprings. But instead of the Mirkwell of Morg, he falls into a Borabel pit. That is a pit some little boy has set to catch a Borabel that has been snuffling around his mother's garden. That's where he trades his sword for a star wand, because the boy wants a sword. In fact, he encounters many children who are about quests, and also young lovers who are about loving, and also people afraid of death. So instead of the Floral Wold at the World's End, he stumbles into an orchard. Instead of the Dolorous House of the Dead Dolmen, he comes upon the house of a sad and lonely woman. Instead of the Western Wellsprings in the end, in all of these adventures, he stumbles through the forest and what? Going in the direction of the Western Wellsprings. You see, he has been pointed in the direction of all the boundary places of the world. Death, the Dolorous House of the Dead Dolmen, sort of the underworld, the lowest, deepest parts of our imagination, the Mirkwell of Morg or the Borabel pit, and the very edge itself, the very edge of the world, the Floral Wold, the World's End, or in the other direction, the Western Wellsprings. But instead of coming to the Western Wellsprings, just like instead of coming to any of these other places, what should he come to as he stumbles through the forest, going in the direction that he has been told lie the Western Wellsprings, where he will surely find the throne of the Earl of Shirl? What does he find?
but once again that he is face to face with where he started, the castle of Magnus Thrall, king of everywhere. Well, he sits down in absolute and utter discouragement at the failure of his quest. And not only failure of his quest, but the failure of himself. I mean, there he is, clothed in leaves and barefoot. But he winds up to be sitting under, here, children again, underneath a child tree. And one of them drops, a child tree is a tree filled with children, of course. And one of them drops down out of the child tree and says, "What, don't you have a mother to tell you everything will be all right?" So this child goes and gets his own mother. Well, the mother comes and comforts him. And he tells the mother the story. And she says, "Well, there's a simple answer to that." He said, "What answer? How do I find the throne of the Earl of Shirl?" And she says, "You must write it yourself." So, chapter 7. And so the knight Carlos wrote a throne. And it was a deep throne. And a dark, haunting, lovely throne. A wild, special, sweet throne, made of the tales and dreams and happenings of his quest. He sat beneath the child tree and wrote it, and the children played and sang and called like birds from tree to tree. They sat on the Dagon's back, that's the dog, and scratched its ears, and they leaned against the night and watched him write. The mother brought them milk and bread beneath the tree, and the knight ate and drank and kept writing. The sun slipped finally behind the dark house of Magnus Thrall, and the silver-belled cows went home across the cool meadow, and the weary children slipped away one by one to sleep. The knight put down his feather pen. "It is a lie," he said. "It is a throne," said the mother, "and it is time for the king to give up his damson so that she can learn to laugh." She held the last waking child to her side, its face resting in her apron. Carlos smiled at the name she spoke. "Yes." He stood up, rolling the throne neatly, and the Dagon sprang to its feet. "I will return now to the king's house. One day I will come back here with Damson, and then I can give you fairly the thanks for your help today." The mother smiled. "That will be fair thanks," she said. "Goodbye, tree man," said her child, yawning, and its plump small hand flashed in the twilight like a star. The knight Carlos rode the silent pawed Dagon over the drawbridge of Magnus Thrall's house. The Dagon followed him up the dark winding stairs, through the empty halls, past silent rooms, to the last high room where firelight flashed red beneath the closed door and a gentle broken voice sang behind it. The knight opened the door. The dark robed shadow that was Magnus Thrall stopped its pacing before the fire. The needle and needlework dropped from Damson's hands, and her face turned toward Carlos, pale and glistening, motionless with astonishment. Then suddenly she began to laugh. Her laughter was high and sweet and full, and the tears of it flashed like starlight in her eyes. She wiped them with her fingers and rose to touch the wordless knight. "Oh, my Carlos," she said in laughter and tears. "Oh, my Carlos, you are barefoot. Why are you dressed in leaves like a tree man? Where is your cloak? Did you really ride this dog instead of your horse? Oh, my fair and proper knight, where are your mouse-colored boots?" "Where," said the king, "is the throne?" "I have brought you the throne," said Carlos, "and now you must keep your promise." He gave the king the rolled throne and looked into the wine-colored laughing eyes of the king's damsel. "Yes," she said. "Yes, I never knew before how much I want a barefoot, leaf-cloaked knight. Oh, my Carlos, how did you find the throne? It does not exist." "I found it," said Carlos, and he put his hands on her face and looked deeply into her eyes. Behind them, the dark king whispered, "The star wand and the golden harp, the dark well and the house of death, the jewel-eyed wise men and the bottomless river and the flower wold at the world's end, the throne! It is the throne!" His voice suddenly shouted like a trumpet. "Take Damson, for I no longer need her weeping, and my heart will no longer wail with longing for a thing which does not exist. I have the throne. I will wake content to the sunlight and simple wind.
Open my doors to the chatter of birds and turtles. I will be content with the green world, with the light that fades and the singing leaves that wither so quickly, for I have the throne of such beauty that will never fade. I will make you my chief knight.
I already am your chief knight, said Carlos.
I will give you fat lands and turtles to toil over them in a house more magnificent than mine for Damson and your sons.
And daughters, said Carlos.
I will proclaim your name in every village and city as the knight who has done the impossible deed of finding the lost throne of the Earl of Sherrill.
Carlos sighed. It is a lie, he said, to the dark eyes of Damson. And Magnus Thrall's voice stopped shouting and quivered. A lie?
I wrote the throne. It is the throne of the knight Carlos.
The knight was silent within the dark king's walls and without. The king stood still as the dark wood of an unlit torch. Damson stopped smiling, her mouth quivered. You wrote this throne? Magnus Thrall whispered. Yes.
How did you write it?
Sitting under a child tree with paper and a feather pen. But I do not need a magnificent house, Damson said wistfully. I need this leaf-cloaked knight with a gentle voice. Magnus Thrall stepped closer to them, his eyes flickering with firelight, his hands clasped tight around the throne.
But where did you find the words for it? The names and dreams and colors for it.
Everywhere, said Carlos to Damson's eyes.
In my land you built this throne?
Carlos looked at him. There was no place else to go. So I built a lie. And now do what you will with me, because there is no place in the world to find that throne you wanted. The king of everywhere took off his crown. He threw it against the stones, and it bounced and spun and rolled into a corner. Then he took the rolled throne of the knight Carlos and flung it into the fire, where little flames danced black across it. You lied to me.
I know, whispered Carlos. You failed your quest.
I know.
You tried to trick me with a false throne to slyly take my damson from me.
But I love your damson, said Carlos helplessly. And Damson, clinging to his leaf-cloaked arm, looked up at him with dry midnight eyes. The dark king's shadow ran like withered ivy across the stone walls. There are knights and knights, he said. There will be other knights to find the great throne, other knights to love Damson, to lead her into the green world. You are not my knight. You are a tree man, with no shield but a silly harp, and no sword but a fading star. I must have the throne for the ease of my longing heart, and I will wait for it in these dark rooms forever if I must, and my damson will wait here with me.
The tree man Carlos sighed beneath his leaves. He sighed again, his leaves whispering, his eyes on the fading star of his throne.
He said softly, then I will go back and look again forever if I must, and damson, if it pleases her, will wait here for me. Damson's mouth trembled. Then she straightened beside Carlos, and her mouth went straight and taut as a new bowstring.
I will not, she said to him.
And her eyes were dry as nights with a thousand stars. I will not wither here in these stones. She turned to Magnus Thrall. I do not care about your throne. I want this moon-haired, barefoot knight, and I will have him, throne or no throne. I want to walk in the singing world. I want to laugh instead of weep. You can weep here alone. I will go with him. She turned back to Carlos and took his hands. And you will write your throne again for me. I have known a fair and moon-colored knight with a horse and shield and sword, and I know a barefoot tree man with a dog and a star wand, and I know which one sang a throne to my heart to make it wake and laugh. I know in all the worlds there is no throne more beautiful than the throne of the tree man Carlos. Words gathered like tears in the tree knight's eyes. He shook his head, smiling through them. No, he whispered. There is one more beautiful throne, and that is the one I will write only for you, my damson.
Bah, said Magnus Thrall.
He looked at the dark, still walls around him. He kicked the fire to make it spark. Flames leaped upward.
But still the shadows clung like cobweb to the silent corners. You will regret it. He is no longer my chief knight. He is mine, said Damson. He brought back dishonor and failure from his quest, and he will have no place in my favor. There is no favor in you for anyone. From my stone walls to his stone walls he will go. No, said the tree knight quickly. I know a place with quiet water and wind singing through trees where I will build a house for you with flowers at your doorstep and cows with cowbells in your field. I would like to hear a cowbell, said Damson. And together, if it pleases you, we will grow a great tree full of children. His Damson smiled. I would like a child tree. Cowbells, said Magnus Thrall. You will be sorry. You will leave him and come back and wait with me for a proper night. I have a proper night, said Damson. And the tree knight lifted her onto the flowered-eyed Dagon. And I will go everywhere with him. Bah, said Magnus Thrall. The fiery breath of the dog lit the dark, winding stones as Carlos led his Damson into the sweet night world of whispering grass and moonlit leaves. The king watched the fire breath fade across the fields like a dying star. In the fire, the ashes of the tree knight's throne crumbled and drifted apart. The dark king stared at them and whispered in the stillness, Bah. The end. Well, hope you like that. Regard it as a present.
Who wrote it?
It's by a woman by the name of Patricia MacKillop, who is one of the leading young fantasy writers, at least to my knowledge currently. She has a couple of other things. The other one that I've read, I'm trying to remember the name of it. Pardon. MacKillop, MacKillip. Patricia MacKillop. It's published by Athenaeum, if you're interested. And you're welcome to look at it if you like to. The Middle is delightful, too. I'm sorry not to read it. I read it over again before we started, and it's really fun. Sort of how he gets divested and all the people he meets and the adventures that eventually go into the throne. Well, okay, here comes my little application. turn it off if you want to. But I think it fits. And when I read it over again, I thought, you know, there is a way in which this book is about the liturgy. That's why I did that. Liturgy: the Throne of the Earl of Shirl. Why so? Well, because it seems to me that indeed the liturgy of the Christian Church, our liturgy, what we sing, is a kind of song, and it is a kind of song gathered from the edges of everything. The words of it are from this world. The images of it are from this world, but they are from quests in this world, quests for life, quests from the edges of everywhere, from the place where Magnus Thrall, that's an interesting name, of course. Magnus Thrall means great slave, the king of everywhere. From the place where Magnus Thrall is king, but from the boundary places of this world, pressing toward death or the depths or the edge, from the boundary places of this life, for quest for life, for looking in all the edges for something more than what there is in this world, and thereby the boundary places of this world. And in the process, our liturgy also sort of takes the armor off. The liturgy is a place where things get reversed. At its best, anyway, it is like getting clothed in leaves instead of in armor. That is to say, the people who are ordinarily in the world regarded as powerful are not necessarily the people who are powerful when we gather. We need to honor the children, honor the powerless, honor powerlessness in us, in ourselves. Leadership in Christian liturgy needs to be done more in a powerless way than in a powerful and overwhelming way. The status quos of this world, the knights and their structure and their status, who is chief knight and who is not, that isn't of any consequence in the liturgy. Those things are slowly taken off in order that in the liturgy one might, in accord with stars and trees, barefoot so that, as the poem would have it, foot can feel, we sing together with all things. That was kind of what I wanted to say the first time we met, about the harmony of all things, ta panta, in the liturgy. It's part of the reason why we need to pay careful attention that what we do in the liturgy is not just more knight's order, not just more of the status quo, that who is paid attention to is not necessarily the powerful of the world, but that in some ways we take those things off, are clothed more in leaves. The statuses of this world are disrupted. And like a song, the liturgy is something we repeat. That's one of the things some people find objectionable about it, I guess. But it's like a song that you sing again and again. Or like saying, I love you, which one repeats again and again. It is like that. Or like the fact that our heart beats, or that we keep on repeatedly breathing. It is like a song with its repetition and rhythm, which accords with our heart beating and our breathing, with the repetition of our I love yous, picking up all the stuff of the world in the song. And it is a song like the throne, which wishes to be the great throne. For us, the great throne is the one imaged in the book of Revelation, you know, the one sung before the throne and before the Lamb. That's sort of the throne of the Earl of Shirl of the book, huh? But our liturgies are not that. They try to be that, but they are made up in our world with our words. And so the liturgy, like the throne of the night, Carlos, is a failure, is a lie. It is not heaven. It is not the kingdom of God. It is always, I talked about that earlier this week, it is always a failure. It always stumbles a little, always a little awkward, always aspires to more than it can produce. As I said, quoting Ronald Grimes, it is a lie in a sense. The liturgy is a kind of lie in the sense that the throne of the night, Carlos, was a kind of lie. And it offers us a choice, I suppose. We could sing a lesser song, one that isn't so powerfully filled with all the images from the edges and boundaries of the world. Or we could despair and say, no, I will sing nothing unless it is the true song. All of this liturgy is too obviously not there yet. Or we could sing this throne. In some ways, my little story of the throne, I suppose I want to just say the same thing I tried to say with the story of the thousand cranes. Make the cranes beautiful, but know that we never make the thousand. The throne is made up of stuff of this world, made up of the quest. In fact, I guess I want to say the quest in the Christian liturgy is all the history of the liturgizing church that is sung in the direction of life, in the hope for the kingdom of God. It is not just that, it is all the singing of Israel on all its quests into the boundary places of everywhere. Now, you might say that that's a counsel of despair. But all that is a kind of saying that the liturgy is just something we made up. It's something we do, something we receive from all those singers before us, and our own song added to the cycle of songs. It is a lie, but it's not really God's song. And then you might say, quest to find something that is truly God's song in this world, some way that it could really be that you're going to sing together or do together what God does. But, you see, I want to say that at the deepest heart of the throne of the liturgy, it is the throne of the Lord Jesus, we say. The liturgy sings in its words and images from this world of Jesus Christ in this world. And it is of his song, including his lament, his, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? His being with us in a land that is not sure. His being with us here, everywhere, in the midst of love and death. His being with us in our quests, his being with Israel in its quests, with the history of the church in its quests. It is his song at the heart that we sing. The throne of the Lord Jesus. And finally, I guess I want to think, twisting the story around a little bit, it is a love song for us. And we are the maiden at our Father's fire. And it is the Lord Jesus who comes to sing to us the song of all the world, gathered together in this song that still waits, still hopes. And his song invites us away from our Father's fire, out into this world. I wanted to say in this time together, this week, that we, that there's a kairos right now, it seems to me, with the introduction of the new book, for growth in worship. And it is a kairos that offers us an opportunity to do some real work in our communal growth and worship. I wanted to suggest that I really hope that what happens in that work is not that we narrow the imaginative focus of worship, but widen it. That we, as I said the first time we met, heighten the tensions. That what comes to expression in the liturgy will be darkness and light, silence and word, men and women, death and life, sorrow and joy, in order to express in our gathering that all things are held together in Christ. The image in the story is of the night questing into all the corners of everywhere and then gathering that into his song. But I've wanted also to say that in this kairos it is important for us to remember that we never make the thousand cranes, or that our liturgy, make it as beautiful as we will, is also always failure. That it was also always a lie. That is not an excuse to not make it beautiful. Because in fact, the more beautiful it is, indeed, the more vulnerable we are, the more our thirst is heightened. But we do indeed need to make it beautiful, like the throne of the night Carlos. But then at the same time to realize its failure. Because at the deepest level, it is the throne of the Lord Jesus. It gathers our failure, our waiting, our hoping for shalom for all things. It gathers it into the cross. What I want to say then is summed up maybe even better by another literary piece. This is a little passage from Alan Patton. You know Alan Patton for his writing about South Africa. And he's one of the most moving and significant of contemporary authors, I think. In 1954, he wrote a little piece in the Christian Century called Meditation for a Young Boy Confirmed, which I came across and have loved ever since. A part of that little Meditation for a Young Boy Confirmed is a passage about the liturgy. Now, this is from 54, and the images of liturgical reference are to the Book of Common Prayer. So if you know the Book of Common Prayer or the Episcopal liturgy a little bit, you will catch the images most clearly, but I think it's applicable anyway. It says in short compass really mostly what I've wanted to say in this time together. Let me read it. I say to my son, these are the visible and outward forms. He means the liturgy.
These are the visible and outward forms. These are the inarticulate gestures. The humble and supplicating hands of the blind reached out. This is the reaching out of children's hands for the wild bird. These, the liturgy, these are the hands stretched out for water in the dry and barren land. This is the searching in a forest for a treasure, buried long since under a tree with branches. This is the searching in the snowstorm for the long-awaited letter, the lost white paper that is blown away. This is the savage seeking a tune from the harp, the man raking the ashes for the charm in the burned-down house. This is man thrusting his head through the stars, searching the void for the incomprehensible and holy. Keep for it always, keep for the liturgy, keep for it always your reverence and earnestness. These are men searching here. They stretch out their hands for no star, for no knowledge, however weighty. They reach out humbly, supplicating, not more than a cubit's length, that haply they may touch the hem of the robe of the infinite and everlasting God. This kneeling, this singing, this reading from ancient books, this acknowledgement that the burden is intolerable, this promise of amendment, this humble access, this putting out of the hands, this taking of the bread and wine, this returning to your place, not glancing about you, this solemn acceptance and the thousand sins that will follow it, this thousand sins and the repenting of them, this dedication and this apostasy and this restoration, this thousand restorations and this thousand apostasies, take and accept them all. Be not affronted nor dismayed by them. They are a net of holes to capture essence, a shell to house the thunder of the ocean, a discipline of petty acts to catch creation, a rune of words to hold one living word, a ladder built by men of sticks and stones, whereby they hope to reach to heaven. Well, I guess I believe that the ladder in the liturgy that we do indeed build of sticks and stones, the discipline of petty acts, which is the liturgy, I think it's a helpful thing to call it that. The discipline of petty acts, which is the liturgy, the ladder built of sticks and stones, the shell to house the thunder of an ocean, is indeed housing the thunder of the ocean, holding one living word, reaching even to heaven. Not because our little sticks and stone ladder gets there, or because our petty acts catch creation, but because before we ever started to build the ladder, God himself and his Son stood at the foot with us. Because of the cross of Jesus Christ. Because he is in the midst of us. In our longing, our reaching out to touch, silly, isn't it? A cubit's length to touch the hem of God's robe. We touch it indeed, not by our discipline, but by his grace, before ever we started to reach. Keep for these things your reverence, your earnestness. I think that's good counsel, and Patton, for my money, captures both of the things I wanted to say in this week. Both the reverence and earnestness for the liturgy, and the sense of its failure. I don't know if we've found ways to hold those things as well intentioned. But I hope that maybe you can take the throne of the Earl of Shurl as a little essay in that direction. Well, that's not very practical stuff. But maybe it's a little spirituality of the liturgy. I think there's a little time yet. And if you want to, I sure would be glad to entertain any of your reflections on this or anything else related to the liturgy, or any questions you might have of impractical or practical nature that has come up either today or during the course of the week.
Which issue is this of the magazine, Christianity? Is that the name?
It's called The Christian Century.
Oh, Christian Century.
And it appeared in October 13, 1954. Anything. Yes.
It ties in a bit with what Professor Yorsten has been talking about. And it seems in our congregations, one of the chief criticisms from people within the charismatic renewal are against our liturgy.
Uh-huh.
And its deadness and its rigidity. And there were some attempts then to half and half it. For me, it did not work. You know, you can't have spontaneity within that part of the service. And I never learned how to have a completely spontaneity, an entire service of spontaneity with everyone.
Yes, without it being forced on some people.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you have any feelings or ideas, Phil, on how to help integrate, you know, in a way it's two different traditions, Lutheran versus whatever is meant in the word.
Charismatic.
Or spontaneity within service.
The article I read recently talked about what this author called the second spontaneity, which I think I like very much. This person used the tea ceremony in Japan as an example. Japanese, of course, know a great deal about beautiful form. And like, say, a good dancer learns the form, and then beyond that learning comes to what you might call a second spontaneity. The possibility within the structure of making the thing be indeed spontaneous, but beyond a discipline, as it were. I guess I like that very much. I'm not sure we've always moved very far in that direction. That is, if our liturgies seem wooden, maybe it's because we haven't learned the discipline well enough, and let it be broad and strong and touching enough things, as it were. But I would really hope that we could, in fact, increasingly move toward the second spontaneity, certainly among the people who are leaders in the service, because that second spontaneity helps to set other people at ease. The other thing I'd say, I guess, I agree with you. A lot of times when we've tried to bring off group spontaneity, my experience of it is that there's a few people who feel it, and a lot of people who feel imposed upon, even though they don't say it that way. The singing group, I remember one time sitting in the congregation while they sang to us of the gospel, but there was a comment that just killed it for me. They said, "You're not smiling," they said. "Why aren't you smiling? You must not be Christians because you're not smiling." Well, you can't do that. You can't say smile, like you can't say believe. What I hope is the central symbols are strong enough that somehow around them you can provide freedom. The Orthodox Church is an example of that. Strong central stuff in the middle. But the people who come to the liturgy, there's a certain freedom. You mill around a little. You do the liturgy for a while, And then you may go out and have a smoke and come back in and do some more. One of my favorite stories is a story about an Orthodox liturgy I went to in India, where there were it was an open air thing, and so there wasn't the great iconostasis that there usually is in front of the altar, so you could see the altar. There were all these crowned bishops in the Orthodox Church, bishops who wear crowns. All these crowned bishops standing around the altar presiding at the liturgy. All of a sudden, in the middle of the liturgy, one of these bishops notes that the candles in the altar aren't lit. So he leans over and whispers to an assistant who scurries off, obviously to get matches, comes back with matches in hand, see? Gives them to this crowned bishop who proceeds to light the matches. I mean, no formal acolytes marching around and turning military corners. Proceeds to light the matches and light the candles on his side of the altar. As if that isn't enough, he then takes the matches, crowns and all, tosses them across the altar, where another crowned bishop deftly catches the matches and proceeds to light the candles on his side of the altar. Well, you know, Lutherans wouldn't be caught dead doing that. What a shame. I mean, we think that decorum in the liturgy means military order. And I think that's really too bad. I mean, I think powerful sinners don't mean making everybody turn right-angled corners. So what I'm saying is, it seems to me if the symbols were strong enough, we could relax a little. Let the kids run around, you know. If the prayers have a leader, you can also relax and let many people pray. Let the congregation offer its bids in the course of the service. That's one way of incorporating fairly easily a little spontaneity without everybody feeling like they've all got to do it. You know, open it up so that in fact bids can come from the congregation, especially if you have a room where it can where it can be heard. At the communion itself, in the process of communion, we don't have to all march up table by table. Maybe communion can be given in many places in the room, and there can be a certain freedom, a flow, a ministering to people. Sometimes you take more time, sometimes less time. That kind of thing, I guess. Does that come at your question?
Yeah, one of the problems that we have in worship in all the parishes I've ever been in is trying to help the people move to get away from the idea of worship as a receiving, exclusive receiving activity, and almost an entertainment element, and somehow to educate. I didn't hear you touching it, but somehow to educate that it's work,
yeah,
and it's giving, and,
yeah,
and there is receiving, but the receiving comes through the giving. It's really a vital kind.
That's absolutely vital. And we ought to spend a lot of time on that, because that's really important thing. That is, for me to talk about the liturgy as our song or as our shared work, that all implies that it's something we do in common. And I really couldn't agree with you more. The general impression of our meetings is, except for hymn singing, is that it's a pretty way a one man, sometimes on rare occasion a one woman show, that the rest of us are recipients of.
I think that speaks to the charismatic kind of concern that Gal,
mm-hmm,
people are up there, because the people, it took me a long time to come to even beginning to understand what my involvement was.
Yeah.
And when that happened, worship began breathing new winds,
yeah,
for me.
Yeah. And we really have got to allow people's ownership of it. That is to say, it is yours. And that's one of the things why I talked with such excitement yesterday about shared leadership, why that's so important. Because while not everybody will be doing it on any given Sunday, and maybe there are people in the congregation who will never do it, nonetheless, the image in the congregation is that it's ours together. Sometimes the way people will own it is simply by their quiet participation in the pew, and that's important. But that they own it in the process is the important thing. Yes?
Going back to what she was mentioning about the criticism of the people in the charismatic or the more fundamental type churches of the liturgy, I'm from one of those churches, and I learned one time, and this is an observation that you people might be able to make with a chuckle, and it's that these people who claim to not have a liturgy become just a set in cement.
Yes.
And if they're criticizing, it's merely that they're comparing one system against another.
That's right.
Because try in many Baptist churches to have the choir sing at a different time of the while.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
When you're announcing.
That's been my experience too. Is that it's just a more recent liturgy, that's all, but it gets set. And my experience also with churches that have so-called contemporary and so-called traditional services is that the contemporary folk are by no means unrigid. Sometimes there's a great rigidity about the so-called contemporary service.
I think people kind of like to have things kind of the same, like we've said this week.
Yeah, there is a sense in which, like,
mm-hmm.
There's a sense in which
your car always works when you get in it. You like to put the key in the same place and your windshield wipers there.
But how to find that, how to find both the reliability and freshness.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing.
For each group, for everybody.
Yeah. Yes.
I wonder sometimes if we go through fast with our liturgy, and not only for those who are first time people, pastors are familiar with the liturgy, but I like to go slow sometimes because those words are so freighted.
Yes.
That, race over them, you really don't have time to dwell on the rich meaning. And I think if we went a little slower, that might even help the charismatic who would then be able to dance around with each word. And
that's lovely. I love that. I like that very much. Yeah, and it seems to me if you know the central structure of the liturgy, you could do that and omit a few things. That is, the shape of the liturgy is gathering, reading the word, having a homily, praying the prayers, setting the table, giving thanks at the table, and sharing the meal. That's the ancient shape of the liturgy. If you know that shape, you can keep that shape, use a few less words, and do the ones you do with a greater deliberateness, dancing around them, as you say. That's wonderful. That's a nice closing word. Thanks very much.